Oppenheimer's first appointments made it seem as if his only priority was to transform the Institute into a major center for theoretical physics. He brought with him as temporary members five research physicists from Berkeley.
After coaxing Pice to stay on, he recruited another promising young English physicist, Freeman Dyson, to become a permanent member of the Institute.
He persuaded Niels Bohr, Paul Dirac, Wolfgang Pauli, Hideki Yukawa, George Uhlenbeck, George Plaschek, Sinitiro Tomonaga, and several other young physicists to spend occasional summers or sabbaticals at the Institute. In 1949, he recruited Chen Ning Yang, a brilliant 27-year-old who would win the 1957 Nobel in Physics with T.D. Li, another Chinese-born physicist Oppenheimer brought to the Institute.
"This is an unreal place," Pice wrote in his diary in February 1948.
"Bohr comes into my office to talk. I look out of the window and see Einstein walking home with his assistant. Two offices away sits Dirac. Downstairs sits Oppenheimer. It was a concentration of scientific talent like no other in the world, except, of course, Los Alamos." In June 1946, well before Oppenheimer's arrival at the Institute, Johnny von Neumann had begun to build a high-speed computer in the boiler room basement of Fould Hall. Nothing so practical had ever existed at the Institute, and nothing so expensive. The trustees initially gave von Neumann $100,000 to get started. And then, in a rare departure from Institute policy, he was allowed to obtain additional funding from the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, the U.S. Army, the Office of Naval Research, and the Atomic Energy Commission. In 1947, a small brick building was constructed a few hundred yards away from Fould Hall to house the computer von Neumann envisioned. The whole idea of building a machine was rather controversial among scholars who thought their job was to think. "There was never anything that we needed a lot of computing for," complained one mathematician, Dean Montgomery. Oppenheimer himself was of two minds about von Neumann's computer. Like many others, he thought the Institute should not be turned into a laboratory funded by defense dollars. But this was different. Von Neumann was building a machine that would revolutionize research, and so he supported the project. Von Neumann agreed not to patent his machine, which soon became the model for a generation of commercial computers. Oppenheimer and von Neumann formally unveiled the Institute computer in June 1952. At the time, it was the fastest electronic brain in the world, and its mere existence launched the computer revolution of the late 20th century. But when the machine was surpassed by better, faster computers in the late 1950s, the permanent members of the Institute met in Oppenheimer's living room and voted to close the computer project altogether. They also passed a motion never to bring another such piece of equipment onto the grounds of the Institute. In 1948, Oppie recruited the classicist Harold F. Chernus, an old Berkeley friend and the country's leading scholar on Plato and Aristotle. That same year, he persuaded the trustees to establish a $120,000 director's fund, which gave him personal discretion to bring in short-term scholars. Using this discretionary money, he brought his childhood friend Francis Ferguson to the Institute. Ferguson used the fellowship to write his book, The Idea of a Theater. At the instigation of Ruth Tolman, Oppie appointed an advisory committee on psychological scholarship. Once or twice a year, Ruth herself came to the Institute with her brother-in-law Edward Tolman, George Miller, Paul Meal, Ernest Hilgard, and Jerome Bruner. Ed Tolman and Hilgard had both been members with Oppenheimer of Siegfried Bernfeld's monthly study group, which had met in San Francisco during the years 1938 to 1942. Gathering in Oppenheimer's office, these eminent psychologists would brief him on the deep questions in their field and otherwise keep him in the picture. Oppenheimer soon gave short-term appointments to Miller, Bruner, and David Levy, a noted child psychologist. Oppenheimer loved to talk about things psychological. Bruner found him brilliant, discursive in his interests, lavishly intolerant, ready to pursue any topic anywhere, extraordinarily lovable. "We talked about most anything, but psychology and the philosophy of physics were irresistible." Soon, other such humanists were joining the Institute, including the archaeologist Homer Thompson, the poet T.S. Eliot, the historian Arnold Toynbee, the social philosopher Isaiah Berlin, and later, the diplomat and historian George F. Kennan. Oppenheimer had always admired Eliot's The Wasteland, and was delighted when he agreed to come to the Institute for one semester in 1948. But it didn't work out. Having a poet in residence didn't sit well with the Institute's mathematicians, some of whom snubbed Eliot, even after he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature that year. Eliot, for his part, kept to himself and spent more time at the university than he did at the Institute. Oppenheimer was disappointed. "I invited Eliot here," he told Freeman Dyson, "in the hope that he would produce another masterpiece, and all he did here was to work on The Cocktail Party, the worst thing he ever wrote." Nevertheless, Oppenheimer strongly believed it was essential that the Institute remain a home to both science and the humanities. In his speeches about the Institute, Oppenheimer continually emphasized that science needed the humanities to better understand its own character and consequences. Only a few of the senior resident mathematicians agreed with him, but their support was critical. Johnny von Neumann was almost as interested in ancient Roman history as he was in his own field. Others shared Oppenheimer's interest in poetry. He hoped that he could make the Institute a haven for scientists, social scientists, and humanists interested in a multidisciplinary understanding of the whole human condition. It was an irresistible opportunity, a chance to bring together the two worlds, science and the humanities, that had engaged him equally as a young man. In this sense, Princeton would be the antithesis of Los Alamos, and perhaps a psychological antidote to it.